We'll now call upon our brother Roger to speak to us this evening to the theme, Entertaining Three Angelic Visitors Together.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, we've already been through a few ups and downs with our couple, haven't we, in the story so far. Times when Abraham has been exceedingly tactful and wise in the matter of this relationship between he and his wife. Times, nevertheless, also when he's let her down badly, when his own faith has proved to be unequal to the responsibilities that lay before him. Occasions when Sarah herself has shown a marvellous spirit of enshrining her husband in her heart and learning to trust implicitly in the Father in time of trouble, and yet also, on another occasion, a woman who desperately sought to contrive according to the flesh in order, as it were, almost to force God's hand in the fulfilling of the promise. And I think that what we learn out of this story, as we've said before, is that this couple, therefore, are ordinary human beings. They're real people. They had all sorts of ups and downs. And by the time we come to the end of the story, we suddenly appreciate that it took time for them to get to that point themselves. It didn't just happen overnight. And I suppose that's the same for all of us as we begin married life, with all of our fond desires and anticipations and aspirations, and we realise that in fact life in the truth, both within marriage and within ecclesial life, is in fact a process of continual development and of continuous education. Well, you remember that in Genesis chapter 17 we have the marvellous promise that was brought forth whereby Abraham and Sarah were truly to be seen as heirs together of the grace of life, as the Apostle Peter puts the phrase in the 1st of Peter chapter 3. And you'll remember that we made the suggestion that again, the circumstances of Abraham and Sarah are, we believe, the historical basis from which the Apostle Peter is drawing his reasoning. That when he says that husbands ought to dwell with their wives according to knowledge, giving honour unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that he had in mind, at least in measure, the circumstances of Genesis 17, when the number of grace was superadded to both their names, and Abraham appreciates now for the first time in his life that they truly were to be heirs together of this promise of the child. And we made the point in our last study, in the course of reviewing Genesis chapter 17, that we believe on that occasion that Abraham's faith leapt ahead, as it were, in absolute belief that what God had promised he was able to fulfil. You'll remember that the record said that he fell on his face and laughed for sheer joy at the promise that had been brought forth. There was absolutely no doubt in Abram's mind that what God had promised he truly was able to fulfil. But there was a problem. And the problem was his wife didn't believe. She wanted to, but she's not yet come to the same point of faith that Abraham has reached in Genesis chapter 7. He believed. And Abraham's faith in Genesis 17 leaps ahead of his wife, and his wife now lags behind in the matter of that confidence in God that was necessary for the bringing forth of the seed. We're going to see that problem in Genesis chapter 18. And I believe for that reason that when we come to the story now of Genesis 18 as we do this night, that although the first verse begins with the words, and Yahweh appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, that the real point of this angelic visitation in Genesis 18 was specifically for Sarah's benefit, and not so much for Abraham's. Abraham has already believed. He's already got implicit faith that God will fulfill the promise. But the visit of the angels on this occasion, I think, was specifically designed to encourage Sarah in her difficulties, that she also might come to that point of belief with her husband. But we're going to find that although the purpose of the visit of the angels was for the benefit of Sarah, that it's all going to be channeled through her husband, and so the appearance will be made to Abram himself. And so chapter 18 and verse 1 starts with these words, and Yahweh appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, says Genesis 18 verse 1. The word plains, by the way, is probably better rendered oaks, and is translated that way by Rotherham's translation amongst others. So he dwelt in the plains among the oaks of Mamre, we might translate the phrase, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. And perhaps the tents themselves were set amongst the oak trees of this particular region, that some shade might be afforded in the heat of the day. It says he sat in the tent door. So in the very entrance of the tent, where perhaps some breeze could be found, Abraham was to be seen sitting on this occasion. We're not told what he was doing. Perhaps he was meditating upon the terms of the promise that had been given to him. Perhaps he was even in prayer. We're told, in fact, that it was in the heat of the day. And the 2nd of Samuel, chapter 4 and verse 5, tells us that the heat of the day came at noon. We're told that specifically in the 2nd of Samuel, chapter 4 and verse 5, that the heat of the day occurred at noon. And Psalm 55 and verse 17 tells us that noon was one of the three principal occasions for prayer in biblical times. So if the heat of the day came at noon, and noon was the time of prayer, then maybe Abram on this occasion, as he sat in the tent door, was in fact among the trees, the oaks of Mamre, deep in prayer to the Father himself concerning the wonder of that promise that had been given to him, that they would truly be heirs together of the quickening grace of life, whereby that son might be born unto them. So there he is. He's in the tent door in the heat of the day. And verse 2 says, he lift up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. Now we know who the men were. We know that they were angels. And so if we come over the page to verse 22, we're told in chapter 18 and verse 22, and the men turned their faces from thence and went toward Sodom, but Abram stood yet before Yahweh. And then, of course, in chapter 19 and verse 1 we read, and there came two angels to Sodom at even. So three men appear. One stays behind to talk to Abraham, who evidently bears the name of Yahweh himself. And the two remaining angels go on to Sodom in chapter 19 and verse 1. So the three men who appeared were really angels. Do you know what's really interesting about that, though? You see, I think what we're being told in a comparison of those three verses, Genesis 18 verse 2, Genesis 18 verse 22, Genesis 19 verse 1, I think we're being told that the primary purpose of these angels was actually to go to Sodom. That was really why they were coming on this occasion. These angels had been given the responsibility to execute a judgment upon Sodom in accordance with the Father's will. But they made a specific detour into Abraham's encampment, especially for Sarah's benefit. I believe that that's why they came on this occasion. They were really going to Sodom, says chapter 19, verse 1. But they especially came into the encampment of Abram on this occasion for the benefit of his wife. Now, when we read Genesis 18 and verse 2, you know, we read it carefully, we almost get a sense of surprise in the narrative, don't we? You see that there? He lift up his eyes and look, and lo, three men stood by him. You know, you almost sense an air of surprise there. Well, I suppose that's not so surprising when we think about it, because, you know, Abraham's encampment could have been anything up to 1,000 people at this time. Now, if you've got an encampment of 1,000 people and they're all in tents, where do you think the chief patriarch's tent would be? And the answer is most probably within the inner circle of the whole encampment. On the perimeter of the encampment would be the guards, of course, of the whole community. So on the outside circle would be young men posted as guards, and the Abrahamic tent would be somewhere in the middle of the encampment of his household. And yet somehow, surprisingly, these three men had somehow managed to slip through all the guards, and they now stood in front of the very tent of the patriarch himself. No wonder Abram was surprised. No one had come to tell that these three men suddenly lifts up his eyes, and there they are, just like that, three men. Now, do you think he knew they were angels? Ah, now that's a good question, isn't it? Do you think he knew that they were angels? Any thoughts on that? Well, hands up those that think yes. Hands up those that think no. Hands up those that aren't sure. Hands up those that are determined to abstain. Obviously, we've got some difference of opinion here. Well, I'll give you my suggestion. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. I believe he didn't know they were angels, not at this stage. He does later on, but I don't think he knew at this particular time. Now, one of the obvious reasons is, and we're going to come to it later on, remember the famous statement of the Apostle Paul in Hebrews 13, be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares, says the Apostle. Remember those words in Hebrews 13, verses 1 and 2. I believe, by the way, that the Apostle took his reasoning on that from this episode. I think it was this express episode that the Apostle had in mind. Now, you know how there's different Hebrew words for men? So here we are in verse 2. He lift up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. Now, it could be Adam or Dam. It could be Ish. It could be Enosh. Which Hebrew word do you think it is for the word men in verse 2? Lo, three men stood by him. You would like to have a guess? Sorry? Ish? Three mighty men. All right, any other choices on that? Enosh? Well, you're right, it is. It's Enosh. Okay, so well done, Barossa Valley. Enosh it is. And you see, the very fact that Enosh was chosen tells us that the appearance of these men is that they were ordinary, common, mortal-looking men. That's what Enosh means, doesn't it? Ordinary men. They looked weary. They looked in need of refreshment. They looked like any other man. You see, I think this was quite different to the visitation of chapter 17. Remember chapter 17? Elohim talked with Abram. He fell on his face. And Elohim went up from talking with Abram. This, the manifestation of chapter 18 is quite different. Three men walk in, and they just look like ordinary, weary men, travel-stained, in need of some refreshment. Just ordinary men. I don't think he understood for a moment at this stage that they were angels. And that makes what he does, I think, even more the remarkable, because look what it says he does. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him, and when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself toward the ground. Now, what a remarkable spirit when you think about it. You see, here's an old man. How old is he? He's almost 100. And it's a hot day. And he sees three men, and you know what Abram's like? That's just, oh, I'll tell you what, that's Abram's spirit. He gathers up his skirts, and he hares off down the road to shake their hands. A remarkable man, Abram. He ran to meet them. There was no need to do that, was there? Not really. But you see, that was the spirit of this man. And he bowed himself toward the ground, which was the common thing of the day to do. And he said, verse 3, my Lord, if now I have found favour in thy sight, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant. When he says, my Lord, in the singular in verse 3, I think evidently one of them obviously looked to be the spokesman, and he addresses himself to the chief of these three men, who, of course, we find out later on, bears the name of Yahweh himself. But Abram didn't know that at this stage. My Lord, he says, if now I have found favour in thy sight. Now, what a remarkable thing to say. Now, here's a man who commands a household of 1,000 people, more or less. And three dusty men appear before his tent. And this old patriarch of his own household says, my Lord, if now I have found favour in thy sight. You know what that tells us about the spirit of Abraham? He was a man of wonderful humility, wasn't he? An interesting extract on the spirit of humility from the Genius of Discipleship. Humility arises from reverence, and reverence is compelled by a realization of what God is. Humility arises from a recognition of the absolute and utter sufficiency of God. Isn't that what Abram had just learned? The all-sufficient power of El Shaddai. It means bowing with awe in the presence of the awful superiority of God. It comes from a recognition of our absolute dependence on God, a sense of our need and his wonderful resource. Humility is not the assumption of a shrinking attitude. It's not a prudent calculation to be lowly. Humility is unconscious meekness, too committed to worry about reputation. You know, that's a very good explanation of the spirit of humility, isn't it? As far as the Bible is concerned. And that spirit was one very much in this record that Abraham clearly has. He wasn't trying, we can, each day of our lives, if we wanted to, we could say to ourselves, well, I'm going to do something else today. Today, I'm going to be diligent. Very easy to do. Tomorrow, I'm going to have integrity. The next day, I'm going to show patience. It's very difficult to wake up and say, today, I'm going to be humble. You can't actually do that, can you? The more you think about how humble you're going to be, the less humble you really are. Humility is a state that springs from our recognition of what God is and of what we're like in comparison to him. And you see, Abraham's come to that point in his life, hasn't he? He's 100 years old now. He's got a dead body, says Romans 4. He knows that there's nothing in his own life now that he can depend upon. The fulfillment of this promise will now completely rest on the operation of Almighty God. There's nothing left of personal pride in Abram. He might be the chief of the clan, but he's a man of abounding humility. And he ran to meet these travel-stained guests, bowed himself towards the ground and said, my Lord, if now I have found favour in thy sight. What a remarkable spirit to come from such a person. And so you see what he says, verse 4. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will fetch a morsel of bread. And this was the spirit of hospitality that was to be seen in biblical times. To bow before the guest, to kiss them, to remove their shoes, to wash their feet, to anoint their head, to offer drink, to offer rest, to offer food. And in that order was the biblical way in which hospitality would be given to the stranger. There's an Oriental proverb which says, every stranger is an invited guest. And that's certainly the way that Abraham ran his household, as we can see on this occasion. And so he urges the strangers here that they might stay and partake of his hospitality. And so he says in verse 5, he says, you rest yourselves, and he says, I'll fetch a morsel of bread. A morsel of bread. When we read the story, it was a pretty good morsel that Abram brought forth, wasn't it? He brought forth unleavened cakes, he brought forth water, he brought forth butter, he brought forth milk, and he dressed a whole calf to set before them. That was a pretty good morsel of bread, wasn't it? You see, that was the spirit of Abraham. There was no stinting in the way that Abraham went about life. You see what he says in the balance of verse 5? I will fetch a morsel of bread and comfort ye your hearts. After that ye shall pass on. For therefore, notice this phrase, for therefore are ye come to your servant. Therefore are ye come. In other words, Abram says, look, I have been given by God here an opportunity to serve you in the truth. That's why you've been brought here, he says, so that I can provide for you. You know, what a marvellous spirit to have in the truth. That whenever we come into contact of anybody who's brought within the scope of our lives, that we could say, therefore are ye come, that we might serve them. That's a generous spirit in the truth, isn't it? And they said, did these three men, so do as thou hast said. And look what he did, verse 6. And Abraham hastened into the tent unto Sarah, and said, make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, and knead it, and make cakes upon the hearth. So, you see, he didn't just walk back into the tent. The record says he hastened into the tent. And you notice what he said to Sarah. He hastened into the tent unto Sarah, and he said, make ready quickly. But you see what the margin says? Why, it's the word hasten again. So he runs into the tent, he hastens into the tent, and he says to Sarah, hasten 3 measures of meal. And you see what he says to the young man in verse 7? He ran to the herd, fetched a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the young man, and he hasted to dress it. You see the spirit of this household? You see, Abraham was a man who was able to imbue others with his own spirit of enthusiasm for the truth. You see, it wasn't just a spirit of saying, oh, well, I suppose you better come in then, was it? And the spirit that bubbled out of Abraham, he passed on to Sarah and he passed on to the young men. And in the end, the whole encampment of Abraham was all roused up, hastening to make this meal, because that's what the patriarch was like. They all partook of his spirit, you see. And what a spirit it was, because you see what he says to Sarah? Make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal. Now, in the Hebrew, the word measures here is the Hebrew word seah, S-E-A-H, seah. And a seah is in fact a third part of an ephah. So therefore, if we've got three seers, and each seer represents a third of an ephah, then how much have we got in total? Not too hard to work that out. We've got one ephah. Now, do you know that in Exodus chapter 16 and verse 16, when the children of Israel in the wilderness gathered together their manna, they were given a certain amount that they were allowed for a man's daily eating need for the whole day. Can you remember what it was? How much were they allowed to gather of the manna, each man according to his eating? Can you remember how much it was? There's a descriptive word given concerning it, a Hebrew word for measurement. They were each allowed a homer, that's right. Now, the interesting thing about that is a homer is the tenth part of an ephah, says the last few verses of Exodus 16. Now, let's just stop and work that through. Abram asks Sarah to make ready three seahs, which in total makes one ephah. The daily eating allowance of manna was one homer, and you had 10 homers to make up one ephah. So, really, you see, what it's saying is that three men have walked into the encampment, but what Abraham asks Sarah to make is enough bread for 10 men. You see, that was the spirit of generosity that he showed. Enough and more than enough. It says that they were actually in the form of cakes, kneaded and make cakes upon the hearth. They were little round half cakes of unleavened bread. They could be cooked up very quickly. In fact, it's the same word used in the 1st of Kings 19 and verse 6. Remember when Elijah was on his way down to Horeb? And remember the command of the angel, arise, Elijah, and drink and eat. And there were little cakes cooked on the coals there. They could be cooked up very quickly. And they would take the meat of the calf and they would slice a section of the meat off and they would cook that up again very quickly. And it was surprising that in biblical times they could in fact bring a meal like this together very speedily indeed. So what they used to do is they would invite the guest in and they would give them water and they could wash and partake of that, and then they would rest. And while the strangers were resting, this meal would be quickly brought together so that it was soon ready for them. Now, just before we move off verse 6, I want you to notice one final thing. Abraham hastened into the tent unto Sarah and said, make ready quickly three measures of fine meal. Do you know that we're told in Genesis chapter 14 and verse 14 that Abraham had 318 armed men in his household? Now, if he had 318 armed men in his household, how many maidservants did he have who could have made cakes? There were maidservants aplenty in this encampment. But Abraham doesn't ask any of the maids. He asked the young man to dress the calf. He doesn't ask a young maid to make the cakes. He goes in and he asks Sarah. You know why he did that? I believe that the reason why he did that was because he's learnt the lesson of chapter 17. And the lesson that he'd learnt in chapter 17, like he'd never learnt it before, is that they are going to be heirs together of God's promise. And I believe that Abram's reasoning on this matter was, well, if we're going to be heirs together, then we must learn, I must learn, to share together. And so they're going to extend hospitality together in this particular chapter. And he invites his wife to share with him in extending that spirit of hospitality to these strangers. Now just have a look at something else in terms of, just to provide a contrast there, to perhaps reinforce that that's the spirit of the passage. Genesis chapter 19, verse 1. There came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, and Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet. Oh, you see, just by the way, a slight difference to Abraham. What did Abraham do? He ran to meet them, not so Lot. Lot rose up to meet them and bowed himself with his face toward the ground. He said, "Behold now, my lords, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house, and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early and go in your ways." And they said, "Nay, but we will abide in the street all night." And he pressed upon them greatly, and they turned in unto him, and entered into his house, and he made them a feast, and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. Where's Lot's wife? Nowhere to be found. But Abram's wife was there. And she was going to extend hospitality with him to these visitors. And it's true, isn't it, brothers and sisters, that the spirit of hospitality springs more readily from a happily married couple. In fact, it's one of the few practical things, one of the few practical areas where husbands and wives can truly labour together in the truth. And in measure, it is a sort of indicator of the extent of unity in a household, the degree of united hospitality that is shown towards others by the husband and the wife of that household. And there's a labouring together. The wife, in order that suitable food might be prepared, enough and more than enough, in the spirit of Abraham. And the husband, well, not only does he participate in whatever preparations need to be made, but he prepares also to ensure that the bread of life is served at the table that day. And that those that come to his household find that there is not only physical food on the table, but opportunity to rejoice together around divine things, in whatever it might be. And husband and wife labour together in the spirit of hospitality. I think that's why Abram asked Sarah to make the cakes. "Let's share in this together," he says, because we really are together in this promise. You know, in John chapter 12 and verse 2, we're told, remember it says the occasion when they made a supper for the Lord, it says that Martha served him. Do you know that the root word for the word where Martha served him is, in the Greek, it's diakonos. It's the same word translated in the 1st of Timothy chapter 8 and verse 13 for the deacons of the ecclesia. So the same word that's used of the deacons in the ecclesia is used of Martha serving food to the Lord. And I believe that what that's saying is that a wife may labour at times in a more practical area than the husband, but they do so with the same spirit as their husbands in making that an offering for the truth. And there are opportunities in the extension of hospitality that husband and wife might labour together. Here's an extract that we, in fact, know quite well from Brother Roberts, but what we've got here is perhaps a fuller extract than we would normally look at from the Law of Moses, where Brother Roberts talks about the bringing together of husband and wife in the truth. Heirs together is the spirit. He says, "Though there is neither male nor female in Christ Jesus, it is by a man and not by a woman that life has come. Though she is instrumentally contributory. For as she was the beguiler of Adam to the death and ruin of both of them, so she is made his rescuer, in being made use of in a virgin descendant of the house of David to bring the Saviour into the world." Male and female are thus coordinate in the scheme without interfering with the headship appointed in the beginning. Man is the head, but only for nurture and protection and honour of the woman. Woman is man's equal fellow heir of the salvation that is offered in Christ, but not to usurp the position that belongs to man, both by natural constitution and divine appointment. Man is for strength, judgment, and achievement. Woman is for grace, sympathy and ministration. Between them, they form a beautiful unit, heirs together of the grace of life. Isn't that a marvellous quotation from our beloved Brother Roberts? That's the balance, isn't it? That's the spirit. Here we've got Abraham and Sarah labouring together as heirs in the very spirit of providing hospitality to others. I believe that Abraham appreciated the involvement of his wife on this occasion and was anxious to ensure that she would be joined with him in the granting of that spirit of hospitality. Well, we're told in the 7th verse, it says, "And Abraham ran unto the herd and fetched a calf, tender and good, and gave it unto a young man, and he hasted to dress it." He obviously ran to the herd to select the particular animal himself. He was anxious to supervise the selection of the right animal. Verse 8, he took butter and milk and the calf which he had dressed and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. You know, when you read these verses carefully, verses 7 and 8, there's almost sort of sacrificial overtones to this meal, aren't there? We've got unleavened bread. We've got a fellowship animal, the offering of a calf that's going to be eaten as a fellowship meal. We've got butter and milk that speaks of the good things of the Word of God. There's almost sort of a sacrificial overtone to the spirit, if you like, of this meal that was prepared. And you see, in a sense, whenever we make an offering on behalf of strangers, it is really an offering to God, isn't it? I'll say that again. Whenever we extend hospitality to strangers, it is really, in a sense, an offering to God, isn't it? Because, you see, strangers can never repay, can they? Not really. And that which we do not just for their sakes, but because that is our spirit before Almighty God himself. Come and have a look at Judges, the book of Judges, chapter 6, which shows a very similar episode occurring in the life of Gideon. And when we read this particular passage carefully, one is struck with the fact that this story obviously is drawing on the experiences of Abraham in Genesis 18. Now, in Judges chapter 6 and verse 15, he says, "He said unto him, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh," Judges 6 verse 15, "and I am the least in my father's house. And Yahweh said unto him, Surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. And he said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me." Now, you notice in the margin against the phrase, "If now I have found grace in thy sight," that the margin makes a cross-reference to Exodus 33 and verse 13. Remember when Moses said, you know, "If I have found grace in thy sight, show me thy glory"? It's not really. I don't think it's a reference back to Moses. I think it's a reference back to Abram. It's a reference back to Genesis chapter 18 and verse 3 when Abram says, "My Lord, if now I have found favour in thy sight." Because what Gideon is going to do on this occasion is he's going to prepare a meal of hospitality for a man that he doesn't know yet is an angel. And the very circumstances of Gideon are going to be taken up straight out of the record of Abraham's hospitality in Genesis chapter 18. See what he says? Gideon says in verse 18, "Depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come unto thee and bring forth my present." And that's really, again, the spirit of Abraham in Genesis 18 and verse 3. He says, "My Lord, if now I've found favour, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant until I have fetched a little water." So the very words of Gideon are, as it were, taken out of the mouth of Abraham on this occasion. And so at the end of verse 18, the angel says, "I will tarry until thou come again." Just as the angels in Abram's time had said, and they said, "So do as thou hast said." And Gideon went in, says verse 19, "and made ready a kid and unleavened cakes of an ephah of flour." Do you know that's exactly the same amount that Abram prepared? Abram prepared 3 measures, which equals an ephah. Gideon went in and prepared exactly the same amount of bread. He put flesh in a basket, he bought broth in a pot, He brought it out and he presented it to him under an oak, says the record. And we're told in the Genesis record that Abraham was dwelling amidst the oaks of Mamre, and that Abraham took the things and set before them and stood under the tree while the angels did eat. You know, this is, I'll tell you what, Judges 16 is straight out of Genesis chapter 18. Now, the point that we're making out of all this, brothers and sisters, is that when Gideon made that offering for the angel, it was very much that. It ended up in verses 20 and 21. It ended up becoming not just a meal, but a sacrificial offering to God himself that was consumed, as it were, upon an altar. And in a very real sense, when we extend hospitality to others, that's really what we're doing, where it's part of our personal offering to the Father himself. And so the circumstances of Abraham's hospitality are taken up in the story of Gideon, using identical language to tell us that this was really an offering to God himself, this marvellous spirit of hospitality. Come back to Genesis 18 and let's just see then that spirit of Abraham in the at the end of the 8th verse. Genesis 18 verse 8, and he took butter and milk and the calf which he had dressed and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. In the Hebrew text, the word he is emphasized. He stood by them under the tree. Why do you think he stood? Any thoughts on that? Why did Abraham stand? That's right, the attitude of a servant. He was waiting upon them. Now here's a man who's a patriarch of a whole household, and he stands as if he were a servant waiting upon them. It's a marvellous spirit, isn't it? Now I'll show you something really interesting. There's three words that take up the spirit that Abraham showed in this chapter as he extended hospitality. Come back to verse 2 and here's the first one. There's three words that really capture the attitude of Abraham in this particular record. Verse 2. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him, and when he saw them, he ran to meet them. There's the first word. You see, he was imbued with a sense of he ran to meet them, says the record. There's the first key word about Abraham's spirit. Here's the second one, verse 6. And Abraham hastened into the tent. And not only did he hasten, but he made Sarah hasten, and he made the young man hasten. So he not only ran to meet them, but he hastened in the fulfillment of the preparation of the meal. And the final key word in verse 8 that we've just read is, they haven't got it already, he then stood by them while they ate. He ran, he hastened, he stood. Now come and have a look at Luke chapter 19. Now here's the spirit of the hospitality of Abraham, marvellously taken up in a New Testament passage here about a man. Well, he was a very little man, wasn't he? The man Zacchaeus, and yet although he was a very small man, he had a very big heart. And his heart was so big that it was in fact just like Abraham's. Because in Luke chapter 19, we read the story of Jesus encountering Zacchaeus. He wasn't able to see. Luke 19 verse 3. And he sought to see Jesus, who he was, and could not for the press because he was little of stature. And he ran before. There's the first key word. See that there? He ran before and climbed up into a sycamore tree. We're told in verse 5 that when Jesus came to that place, he looked up and saw him and said unto him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide at thy house. You see what Zacchaeus did, verse 6? And he hastened. Second key word. He hastened. He made haste and came down and received him joyfully. You see the word received there in Luke 19 and verse 6? The word received there means in the Greek to admit under one's roof and to entertain hospitably. That's interesting, isn't it? That's the very spirit of Abraham, isn't it? The word received in verse 6 is to admit under one's roof and to entertain hospitably. And with what spirit would Zacchaeus do it? Verse 4, he ran before. Verse 6, he made haste. And here's the third key word, verse 8, and Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord. And the three words that are used in Genesis 18 to take up the spirit of Abraham and his spirit of hospitality are all found here in the life of little Zacchaeus, who had a big heart. And you know what the Lord said to that man that day in his house, verse 9? And Jesus said unto him, this day is salvation come to this house, for as much as he also is a son of Abraham. So the Lord knew his scriptures, didn't he? Because this man, on this occasion, had shown the same enthusiastic spirit of Abraham himself. As the Lord himself was to say on a later occasion, as he remonstrated with the Pharisees of his day, he said in the Gospel of John later on, if ye were Abram's children, ye would do the works of Abram. And the works of Abram, Zacchaeus did, in the extension of hospitality and admitting under his roof on this occasion none other than the Lord himself. And so we come back then to Genesis chapter 18 concerning that spirit then of hospitality. So it's a Bible principle, isn't it? Those that are faithful in the truth will endeavour to take up the principle of hospitality in their lives. Romans chapter 12 and verse 3. Distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality, is one of the virtues urged upon us by the apostle in his exposition in Romans. In the 1st of Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, a bishop must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behaviour, given to hospitality, apt to teach. So the very spirit of Abraham and Sarah that's found in this chapter is taken up elsewhere in the Bible as a spirit that is virtuous to follow. The 1st of Peter chapter 4 verses 9 and 10. Use hospitality one to another without grudging. Because you see, Abraham never begrudged what he gave. The Abrahamic spirit of hospitality never had anything grudging about it, did it? As every man hath received, even so minister. And lastly, of course, that phrase that we referred to earlier, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 1, which we believe to be based on this very episode, be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. And you know, brothers and sisters, it's a funny thing, but we live in a life, we live in a time, we live in an age of peace and of plenty, where everybody has, as it were, more than sufficient for our needs. And yet for all of that, the spirit of hospitality that was shown by the patriarchs, Abraham and his wife Sarah on this occasion, is not altogether seen in ecclesial life at times as we would like it to be. I must say, by the way, that I've got no personal complaints in that regard. I'll go home loaded down with the feeling of hospitality from the ecclesia in this place. But you know, it is something that we can think about in terms of our own spirit in the truth. I think in every ecclesia, there are those who somehow get left out. Those who are thoughtlessly ignored. Those who never do experience the spirit of hospitality. So what I'd like you to do right now is to take a piece of paper and to write down the names of four people in the ecclesia that you've never invited to your house in the last 12 months. Now, you don't have to say anyone else. Either four people or four families that you've never ever entertained hospitably in your house. You see, it's interesting, brothers and sisters, you know, we often say, well, nobody ever invites me. No, who have you invited to your house? Now, you don't have to be married to do this. Could be anybody, married or single. It's a spirit of Abraham, isn't it? So write down the names of four people who you've never invited, from the ecclesia, by the way, who you've never invited into your house for at least the last 12 months. So, 2 minute break while you think about that. Alright, so four names. Wasn't too hard, was it? fact, you might have even been able to write 8 down. Or perhaps even 12. Or more again, of those who you suddenly thought, actually, now I think about it, there's quite a few people that we've never invited to our house for quite a long time. You know, that spirit of hospitality, remember what we've said, it's not just the giving of the food, is it? It's also the distribution of the bread of life. A day in another brother's house for the partaking of physical food, and also for those mutual discussions together around the bread of life. You know, I think every ecclesia would benefit from an increase in the Abrahamic spirit of hospitality. Now, did you get that down on a piece of paper? Good. Now, what I'd like you to do is to take that piece of paper, and I'd like you to put it in the Gospel of Luke chapter 12. So, get the piece of paper and put it in your Bible in Luke chapter 12. Alright, everyone got it in Luke chapter 12? Right, now you can turn back to Genesis chapter 18. Okay? Alright, I'll tell you, everyone wants to know why Luke 12, don't they? Well, you see, Luke 12 not only talks about the spirit of those that give meat to the household in due season, a spirit of care for the ecclesia, but Luke 12 is the daily reading in 4 Sundays' time. And you're going to come into the meeting, and you're going to open your Bibles to hear the daily reading, and out's going to fall a piece of paper with 4 names, and you think, oh, that's right, I haven't invited any of those people. I really must get onto that. In 4 Sundays' time, that note will fall out of your Bible. Luke chapter 12. You'll get there sooner than you think, all right? So coming back to Genesis chapter 18 then, we take up the record then in the 9th verse. And by the way, I think it's interesting, this story of hospitality, because do you know that the real point of Genesis 18 is to talk about the visit of the angels to discuss the birth of the son to Sarah? And that's what verse 9 is going to go on to talk about. The real story of this chapter is the time that the angels came to encourage Sarah about the birth of the son. And yet the chapter goes on and on and on and on and on and on for at least 9 verses about the meal they had first. You think, I wonder why the Bible spends all that time about the preparation of a meal. Well, you see, think about it. It's significant, isn't it? Because, you see, God is pleased to bless his servants. God is always pleased to bless his servants. But how much more pleased is God to bless us when we have already shown that spirit of care and love for others that is the very character of the Father himself? And so it's interesting that the very encouragement that is now going to come from the angels to that family is, as it were, born on the background of their own gracious spirit of hospitality to others. Of course, God would be pleased to bless them with the child, given that they had that spirit. And so verse 9 says, "And they said unto him, Where is Sarah thy wife? And he said, Behold, in the tent." Now, that's actually quite interesting, because do you know that, you see, if you come back to Genesis chapter 17 and verse 21, it says, "My covenant will I establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time next year." And I believe that the phrase "at this set time next year" means 12 months from then. NIV says, "By this time next year." Jerusalem Bible says, "at this time next year." So in other words, the promise of the child in chapter 17, verse 21 was that 12 months from now, the child would be born. But when we come to chapter 21, we find in chapter 21 and verse 2 that it's not until chapter 21, verse 2, that the child is even conceived. So the child is going to be conceived and born in chapter 21. And so what we're dealing with, if the child was going to be born 12 months later, but it's not conceived until chapter 21, then everything that happens in chapter 18, chapter 19, chapter 20, actually all takes place in just 3 months, including the visit to the house of Abimelech. Now, how long had Sarah had a new name for by the time the angels came? And the answer is, at the very most, only a few weeks. Would that be right? By the time the angels come to visit in Genesis 18, Sarah's only had her new name probably for a few weeks at the very most. There's only 3 months, remember, for the whole story, right through to chapter 21. Now you think about how Abraham must have felt in Genesis 18, verse 9. So the meal's ended. And he's entertained strangers, unawares that they were angels. And they said unto him, "Where is Sarah thy wife?" And immediately Abraham's head jerks around. Nobody else knows that. Even Abraham's only just starting to practice to use it properly. Three men walk in who he's never seen before in his life, and they know his wife's new name. You know, I think that as soon as they said that in Genesis 18 and verse 9, he knew immediately that they were no ordinary men. Who were these unusual men who somehow had slipped into the middle of the encampment and now, just casually as it were in the course of conversation, know his wife's new name? You can almost sense the surprise in Abraham. You see verse 9, they said unto him, "Where is Sarah thy wife?" And he said, "Behold, in the tent." You can almost see him taken aback with surprise at the fact that the angels knew the name of his wife. And now I want you to notice this in verse 9. You know, when the angels said to Abram, "Where is Sarah thy wife?" Do you know who they were really speaking to? I believe they were really speaking to Sarah. And they deliberately asked that, not merely to arouse Abraham's attention, but so that those words would be heard by Sarah herself. So here she is in the tent door. Actually, notice that, by the way. She's in the tent door. So you see, although she prepared in the helping of the meal, when the time for hospitality came, she stood back, and it was Abraham that came forward with the meal and served the guests. She wasn't forward in the text, was she? She doesn't come forward and dominate. She's not assertive. She's happy to remain in the background. She's in the tent, but she's close enough to hear. So the angels say, "Where's Sarah thy wife?" I'll tell you what, if she wasn't at the tent door, she was at the tent door very shortly after that saying. As soon as she heard that, you know, wives never do mean to hear things that happen in the next room, but it happens. I mean, life's like that. Husbands are like that too, by the way. It's not really just something for wives. And here she was, working away in the tent. She suddenly hears, "Where's Sarah thy wife?" Ooh, tiptoe, just to the edge. I know they're talking to my husband, but... And you see, I believe that the angel said that deliberately to attract her attention. And here it was, verse 10. "And he said, I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life. And lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son." And Sarah heard it in the tent door, which was behind him. Her interest had been quickened. Now, we haven't got time to look at this passage at this stage, but we're going to look later on at Romans chapter 9. And Romans 9 says that when the angel said on this occasion, "I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life," Romans says that that is, as it were, the pith and the kernel of the promise made to this man. It says in Romans 9, "For this is the word of promise, I will come," says Romans 9, verse 9. And you see, the promise of this verse was that it was absolutely essential that Sarah understand that she also had to bear this child and not just Abraham. And the promise of the angel here was of the outflowing spirit power that would quicken Sarah in order that she might be able to bear that particular child. And so we're told, Sarah did indeed hear what the angel said. And so verse 11 says, "Now Abraham and Sarah were old and well stricken in age. And it ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women." Abraham and Sarah were old and well stricken in age. Does that phrase ring a bell? Well stricken. Do you know that phrase is taken up? We won't turn to it because we haven't got time, but you might just like to take a note of the Gospel of Luke chapter 1. Now, of whom does Luke 1 talk about? Well, it talks about, doesn't it, Zacharias and Elizabeth. And it says of them in the 7th verse of Luke 1, "They had no child, and they were both now well stricken in years," says Luke 1, verse 7. You know the meaning of their names, Zacharias and Elizabeth? Their names put together mean, "Yahweh hath remembered the power of his oath." And a boy was born to that couple, old and well stricken in years. You know what they called him? What did they call him? They called him John. What does John mean? The grace of God. You know, you wonder if Zacharias and Elizabeth's minds would have flashed back to this earlier couple who also were well stricken in years in an earlier time of biblical history, and that their own faith and confidence would have been greatly boosted by the story of Abraham and Sarah on an earlier occasion, who also had been well stricken and who yet had nevertheless brought forth a child at the appropriate time. You see what the balance of verse 11 says? It says it ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Now you've got to think about this. You see, Sarah has been barren now for a good many years. And yet what this verse is telling us is that for year after year after year, Sarah had experienced all the normal signs of ability to bear children. The cycle of womanhood. All the signs were there in her body to tell her that she could bear children, but she never had. And now, says verse 11, even that cycle has stopped. And on that basis, we're told that Sarah's reaction, therefore, in verse 12 was that she laughed within herself, saying, after I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also. And you see the word therefore, and that word's very important. You see how it connects verse 11 and 12. Abram and Sarah were old, well stricken in age. It ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Therefore, Sarah laughed. And that tells us immediately what type of laugh she gave, doesn't it, really? You see, remember in our previous study, Abraham had laughed in faith, hadn't he? Remember that? As he fell on his face and laughed for sheer joy that the son was to be born. And we believe that Isaac got his name, Laughter, in commemoration of his father's laughter in faith. But you see, Sarah, when she laughs on this occasion, she doesn't laugh with that spirit at all. It's a completely different laugh that Sarah laughs in this particular chapter. So let's just review the laugh then of Sarah in Genesis chapter 18 here. The first thing is, you see, that Sarah had been barren all her married life, says chapter 11, verse 30, and she'd come to perceive this as a restraint from God for so long that she now had doubts that it could ever be removed. She really did. She had doubts that it could ever be removed. And not only that, but see, as we've seen here, she had experienced up to this point of time the cycle of womanhood despite her barren state. But now through waxing old, it had ceased to be with her after the manner of women. And so her age now had extinguished all natural hope of bearing seed. And not only that, but you see, and this is a key really, is that you see, Sarah says in this chapter, she says, shall I have pleasure? And the word pleasure, by the way, in the text there in the Hebrew means delight, that which brings delight. Shall I have pleasure? And so you see, the matter of a child was a very personal one, a very intimate one, a very emotional one. And I believe that Sarah had been haunted by this problem for so long that she could not open her heart to the fullness of faith for fear that she might be hurt again if the promise didn't come to pass. She desperately wanted to believe, but she'd been hurt by this for 25 years, and she's too scared to open up her heart and believe just in case it doesn't happen. It's better just to not believe. Poor Sarah. And her attention, you see, was focused on her own feelings of inadequacy and weakness, which were a barrier to conception. Now, you see what verse 12 says. Now, give me the key word on the basis of that quotation there in Hebrews 11. What's the key word in verse 12? Would I like to have a crack at that? No. But very warm. Herself. That's the key word, isn't it? You see, You see what Genesis 12, 18 verse 12 says? Therefore Sarah laughed within herself. That's where the problem was. The problem was all about her own thoughts and her own feelings of inadequacy. And Hebrews 11 verse 11 says, through faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed. And I believe that the apostle takes that one word, just that one word, out of Genesis 18 and verse 12 and says, there was her problem. So you think about Hebrews 11 verse 11. Through faith, Sarah herself received strength. You didn't need to use the word herself. Why didn't the apostle just say, through faith, Sarah received strength? But he added the word herself, because that was where the problem really was. It was inside her. And you see, there's a reason for this. You've got to listen carefully to what I say now. You see, men and women think differently. Men think logically. And by that I don't mean that women necessarily think illogically, but that women think intuitively. See, when Abraham was given the promise in Genesis 17, God laid it out. He says, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to be El Shaddai, and I'm going to change your name, I'm going to add grace, I'm going to bring your wife into this. And he laid the whole thing out, and Abraham could see it. Step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, step 5. That's it, I believe. That's logical, says Abraham. But a woman doesn't think that way. You ask a woman, you say, what do you think? She says, well, I think step 5. You say to her, how did you get there? How did you know? She says, oh, I just know that it's step 5. But she hasn't reasoned it out in the same logical way necessarily that a man has she? They're different. And you see, Sarah wanted to believe, but she was faced with the indisputable evidence of her own body, and she couldn't see past that. And she felt intuitively that that child could not come to pass, could not be born. But intuition is not faith. And Sarah was going to have to see through this particular difficulty in life and to develop confidence in God. At least in Sarah's defense, we might turn to the record of the 2nd of Kings 4. Funny how you've got Bible echoes all over the scriptural record. Haven't you? You notice in the 2nd of Kings 4 in verse 8 it says that it fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem where there was a great woman and she constrained him to eat bread. So you see, here's a woman showing the spirit of hospitality. That's interesting, isn't it? And in verse 14 he said, what's to be done for her? And Gehazi says, she's got no child. And so verse 15 said, call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the door. That's interesting. Why do you think it tells us she stood in the door? Who else stood in the door? Sarah. In the tent door. And he said, verse 16, said Elisha, about this season, according to the time of life, thou shalt embrace the son. You know, that's the very words of the angel out of Genesis 18. Elisha's statement on this occasion is straight out of the mouth of the angel in Genesis 18. Now, you see, here's a woman who's described as a great woman, and I believe she was a great woman of faith. And you know how she reacted to the promise of Elisha? She says, verse 16, she said, nay, my Lord, thou man of God, do not lie unto thy handmaid. That's how she felt. This was a very emotional thing for her, wasn't it? And you see the problem with this household, verse 14. Gehazi answered, verily she hath no child. Now listen to this. And her husband is old. So you see the implication of the 2nd of Kings 4 is, whose fault was it in this particular family? It was the husband's. And she couldn't believe, even though she was a great woman, the promise of Elijah. But in Sarah's case, she knows that it's not her husband's fault. She knows that it's hers. And that made it 10 times worse. And she struggled to believe with the promise She struggled to believe in the promise of the angel on this occasion. So coming back to Genesis 18, we're told, verse 12, "Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, 'After I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?' And Yahweh said unto Abraham," verse 13, "Wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I of a surety bear a child which am old?'" Now you see what the record says. It says that the angel said, why did Sarah laugh? But verse 12 says that she laughed within herself. Sarah didn't laugh out loud. She laughed inside. And yet this man heard her laughing. God knows our innermost thoughts and feelings, doesn't he? Whether good or bad, brothers and sisters. And so verse 14 says, "Is anything too hard for Yahweh? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." And so you see, here was Sarah's mistake. You see, despite her personal feelings of inadequacy, what she was really saying was that God couldn't bring forth the child. And that was wrong, wasn't it? She might have felt inadequate herself, but she should never have imagined that God was unable to perform the promise. She should have had the spirit, really, of Mark 9, verse 24. Remember the words of a man in the New Testament who said, "Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief." Isn't that what Sarah should have said? You see, she was halfway there, wasn't she? She was halfway there. She realized it was beyond her. But she had to go further and to see that it wasn't beyond God. And none of our problems in life, brothers and sisters, however large they might loom in our minds, are ever beyond the ability of God to sort out and to dispel. And so verse 15 says, "Then Sarah denied, saying, 'I laughed not,' for she was afraid." And isn't that a typical reaction when we're caught in life's problems? We're caught in a situation, our attitude is wrong, and we won't acknowledge it. We won't come out and say, "You're quite right, we did wrong." You know, we all find it difficult to acknowledge fault in life. And so her immediate reaction was to deny all knowledge. "No, I didn't." You know, we'll never overcome life's problems if we deny that which we really have done, or that which we really have said, either in marriages or in ecclesial life as a whole. One of the greatest spirits that any of us can manifest in ecclesial life is to be able to say, "You're quite right. I was wrong. And I apologize." But Sarah couldn't do that, not just at the moment. She's under pressure, isn't she? Here's this man who knows all about her. Here she is hiding in the tent door, and a man outside who knows her name, who knows that she laughed inside when she never actually made any sound. No wonder she was frightened. So she said, "I didn't." And you see what he says, verse 15? He says, "Nay, but thou didst laugh." And do you know why the angel said that? Do you know why the angel, you see, he's forcing her, isn't he? Do you know why he said, "Thou didst laugh"? I believe it was for this reason. You see, the angel wanted to impress upon Sarah not only that he knew that she had laughed, but that he knew why she'd laughed. That's what he wanted to make her think about. He wanted her to get to grips with an acknowledgement that the problem lay in her own personal feelings of inadequacy. And do you know, I think that this episode had momentous implications for Sarah. I believe this was the turning point. When the angel said, "Is anything too hard?" and expressed a knowledge of her innermost thoughts. Do you know that later on, Hebrews 11, as we've seen, puts it this way. Hebrews 11 says, by faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive and brought forth a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Now, who was the one faithful who had promised? And I believe in this context it was the angel that she'd come across in this chapter. In the end, she judged him to be faithful, a man that knew her innermost thoughts. She judged that God, through this one, this angelic visitation, was faithful to what he'd promised, and that it would be accomplished. But she hasn't quite got there yet. Almost, but not quite. Verse 16, and we'll close with this because I see our time is gone. "And the men rose up from thence and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. That's very typical of what we'd expect of Abraham, isn't it? The guests leave and Abraham walks out to take them on their way. Even a little thing like that is part of the spirit of hospitality, isn't it? You know, you have guests and they're about to leave, and you either say goodbye at the door, see you later, shut the door, or you go out. They get into their car, and as they drive away, you wave goodbye. It's all part of that final spirit of hospitality. The very moment they leave, isn't it, we can be Abrahamic with that spirit in ecclesial life of care. Abraham went with them to bring them on their way, just what we'd imagine of such a man. Now you notice, just from looking at that, you notice how that although this story is really for Sarah's benefit, you notice that it's all channeled through Abraham. You see that? Look, verse 9. And they said unto him, where's Sarah thy wife? And he said, in the tent. And he, the angel, said, I will certainly return unto thee, and Sarah shall have a son. Now Abraham and Sarah were old and well stricken in age. And verse 13, and the Lord said unto Abraham, wherefore did Sarah laugh? And Sarah denied, and Abraham went with them to bring them on his way. The whole dialogue is carried on through Abraham. And I believe the reason for that was to focus Abraham's mind on that which was preventing the child of promise. His wife's unbelief. It's your responsibility, Abraham, to bring up her thinking and her mind and her faith to that point where that child can now be brought forth. It's your responsibility, Abraham. You're heirs together, but you're the head of this house. Now you take her up and you bring her to that point. And so the whole dialogue is conducted through Abraham, that Abraham might see that there was a need here for his own spirit of sacrifice for the building up of his wife, that she might share in his faith. The lesson then of Genesis chapter 18. The experience of life and our dealings with God should develop within us the spirit of humility. There are many opportunities for service in the truth, and they should be executed with eagerness and enthusiasm. The finest service seeks no reward, but becomes an offering unto God. Abraham displayed this in his warm-hearted hospitality, and Sarah provided loving cooperation. Faith is a power that will help us to overcome physical weakness and personal inadequacy. With God, nothing is impossible, and He will empower us, provided we acknowledge our need before Him. These are the lessons that were learnt by this marvellous couple when, on this momentous occasion, they did indeed entertain three angelic visitors together.